Contrary to popular belief, most guys with man breasts cannot just bench press their way to perfect pecs. They have a medical condition called gynecomastia, and Dr. Frank Lista of the Plastic Surgery Clinic can help. A world-renowned plastic surgeon, Dr. Lista has perfected the procedure for correcting gynecomastia. Find out more at theplasticsurgeryclinic.ca. Get off the bench and into the game. Theplasticsurgeryclinic.ca.
Three things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company: politics, religion, and money. Better add sports, too. And since he's not always polite company, he'll maybe address all four. Jeff Blair and the Jeff Blair Show. Now. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show. The winter meetings start in Nashville, Tennessee. Officially on Monday, unofficially on Sunday. That's when Ben Nicholson-Smith will lead the Sportsnet contingent. I mean, I understand we rented a whole hotel.
That's the plan. That hotel is massive, though.
Yeah, that is. You should be able to squeeze everybody into the lovely Opryland, which is just... I mean, really, you lose... It's like flying into O'Hare. I was once told that every time you fly into O'Hare, you lose a day off your life.
Well, it's a city unto itself.
Yes, and I think every night you stay in Opryland, you lose half a day off your life.
That's probably
fair. Become less of a human being.
Well, you don't see daylight, so that doesn't help.
No, that does not help. It is interesting to look out of your hotel room and see the riverboat go by, the little tiny riverboat go by. That's nice, but... Other than that, it's, especially around this time of year, it is Christmas on steroids. It really is Christmas on steroids.
Right. All it's the shopping.
Way too many happy Americans in one spot. That makes me nervous when I see a lot of happy Americans in one spot.
Yeah, absolutely. They're definitely in full force that
yes.
time of year.
Yes. So the winter meetings are in Nashville at the Opryland next week. Ben Nicholson-Smith, baseball editor at Sportsnet.ca, co-host of the At the Letters podcast, joins us in studio. He will be down there along with a number of Sportsnet people as we give you wall-to-wall coverage. And get it. See what I did there, wall-to-wall, because it's hotel? That's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
That's very good.
We will not leave those walls.
You will not leave those walls. Wall-to-wall coverage of the winter meetings. Ben, just a general question. We're Tuesday. The winter meetings start on Monday, as I said. We have been led to believe that Tony LaCava, the interim general manager, and Ross Atkins, an assistant with the Cleveland Indians, are the two finalists for the GM's job. I'll ask you, first of all, do we expect an announcement before the winter meetings?
I personally would expect one. That's just... more of a guess than anything concrete, but you're thinking, okay, you have this big event coming up, and it would just make more sense for the Blue Jays to have that uncertainty over with, mm-hmm. whether it's LaCava or Atkins or even somebody else. I mean, I would guess that this is a logical time to sort that out.
If it was Tony, wouldn't you just say it's Tony by now?
You'd think so.
I mean, I'm not asking you to go into Mark Shapiro's head or anything like that, because we don't know. And there may, I mean, it's December 1st. It's entirely possible that there was a contractual issue with Ross Atkins or something like that, that had him under contract until the end of November. I don't know. But you'd think if it was Tony LaCava, we'd know by now, wouldn't you?
You'd think so, although I do get the sense that Shapiro is a very process-oriented guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to go through all of the steps that the commissioner's office outlines. Okay, you're going to interview this many candidates. You're going to interview a diverse group of candidates. Maybe you get some names out there from four people, doing them some favors in a sense, even if they weren't necessarily going to get the job. But it certainly seems like Atkins, LaCava, these are very strong candidates for the job. And I would fully expect that one of them will be the GM.
Tomorrow is the deadline, Wednesday, December 2nd, to tender. What is the official title of it? The
tender deadline.
Tender deadline. Leave it to me to make something relatively simple, complicated. What does that exactly mean for the Blue Jays? And in particular, what does it mean for one Ben Revere?
I think that, so generally, it's just the date by which teams have to decide whether their arbitration-eligible players are coming back. So for mm-hmm. Ben Revere, he's projected at $6-7 million. And that's a number that I think would be right around the level that he should be making. So I think he would have a little bit of trade value if the Blue Jays were to put him on the trade market. And with all of the left fielders they have, Saunders, Dalton Pompey, Kevin Pillar, of course, being your center fielder, I think they have enough options there that they can at least consider trading from their outfield depth. And maybe if they can get, say, a controllable middle reliever, someone with options, someone with some upside, is that the kind of deal that they would look at? I don't know. That's me speculating, but mm-hmm. I would think that that would be the type of deal that they might discuss, just given that they're dealing from a position of strength there.
Doesn't Ben Revere, though, have a skill set that nobody else in the organization, maybe Dalton Pompey has it, but I'm thinking of the ability to make real good contact, a left-handed hitter. We know he's got speed. And, defensively, he's okay in left field. I don't think he's, by any stretch of the imagination, a gold glove outfielder, but you can get by with him. You can get by with him in left field. And I admit my perception of his defense is forever clouded by watching him play center field for the Phillies. So having said all that, in some ways, isn't Ben Revere wouldn't he be a hard guy to get rid of? Because I don't know where else you get that skill set. And I guess the obvious question, who'd be your leadoff hitter?
Yeah, for sure. And you don't necessarily want to put Tulowitzki back there. Left field, you have the question mark of how would Pompey respond to everyday playing time. Mm-hmm. But this is, I guess, where you get into the question of all these moving parts. Because if you do keep Ben Revere, then I don't know what you can do with Michael Saunders, really. I mean, do you bring him into spring training, this guy who was supposed to be your everyday left fielder, and clearly at that point he would not have a regular job on this team. So if you do bring Revere back, what do you do with Saunders then? Does that make him a non-tender candidate?
Yeah, it's, if it was me, I would non-tender Saunders. But again, you're right, $6 to $7 million, that's about what I think Ben Revere should be making. But again, you're right. There are other moving parts. I think we're safe in saying, and this is probably going to drive people to Twitter, but my sense is that barring some sort of deal where the Jays maybe have R.A. Dickey and somebody else in a package for, a youngish starting pitcher from a team that thinks it needs a veteran to contend, all that good stuff, that all of that aside, we're probably pretty much, this is probably the rotation you're going to have.
I think so.
In some form.
Yeah, I
isn't
think so.
It? Maybe Aaron Sanchez goes into the rotation if you get that bullpen arm. But I think we're, from my point of view, this is kind of the rotation you're going to have, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not exactly the rotation that the Blue Jays ended the season with. And I think that there's been so much hand-wringing about David Price. But I mean, realistically, the Blue Jays were a good team even on the days that David Price wasn't starting last year. And people, it's easy to forget too, he made 11 starts down the stretch. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though he was pitching every day. They played 162 games and he started 11 of them. So, you have to find ways to win when your ace is not on the mound. It doesn't look like the Blue Jays are going to have an ace unless Marcus Stroman can take a big step forward. But it doesn't necessarily mean doom and gloom like the Red Sox had last year. You can have things go the other way where you stay in the race as the Royals did, you're able to add at the deadline. So you're not exactly locked into this world where you're stuck with number four and five starters.
Yeah, and as I took a little bit of grief for saying this yesterday and for writing this yesterday, but I really believe as I look at this rotation, if this is the rotation that the Jays break spring training with, and I'm assuming as part of it, a healthy, effective Aaron Sanchez is part of the rotation, I really think that this is a better rotation than the one the Jays broke camp with last year. I don't even think I think it might be measurably better.
And the bullpen could be better as well if they go out and add some pieces. So at that point, you're looking at a pitching staff that could be markedly better from the one that we watched at the beginning of this year when guys like Felix DuBrant were taking starts and Scott Copeland. I mean, they really patched things together early on. And even though this group isn't spectacular, I would agree that the group they have now can at least be solid, and paired with a good offense, that can be enough to win a lot of ballgames.
Is that going to be enough for the fans? That having people tell them that, is that going to be enough for the fans?
I don't think it is now. I mean, right. I would think that, seeing your Twitter mentions after your piece went up on sportsnet.ca yesterday, I don't think it is enough right now, but that's maybe inevitable. I mean, you're not going to be able to keep the fan base happy at every single turn of the offseason. And really, it's not a question of winning the offseason. You know, the Blue Jays have had off seasons a couple years ago where they quote unquote won the offseason. Mm-hmm. That didn't get them that far. So at this point, I think they needed kind of a B offseason, and I think they're a good chunk of the way there. I don't think they're there yet because they still have holes in that bullpen. They still, in my opinion, should add some catching depth. So this offseason isn't over, but I think that they've taken strides towards having a pretty solid offseason.
Where do you think David Price ends up?
I tend to guess the Red Sox.
Yeah.
But I could see, you know, you could see Cubs, Dodgers, Giants.
I've kind of thought of the Giants as a bit of a dark horse for him, although it does appear as if the Red Sox really are really intent on being the team that really makes a play for him. And if that's the case, David Price with the Red Sox, how upset do you think Twitter will be when that happens?
Very upset. I think, yeah, that would be.
They just go off Twitter that particular day.
Oh, avoid it at all costs, for sure. Yeah.
In conversation with Ben Nicholson-Smith, baseball editor at Sportsnet.ca, co-host of the At the Letters podcast, along with Arden Zwelling. The baseball winter meetings start Monday in Nashville, Tennessee, and Ben will be down there along with a cast of bazillions from Sportsnet. We'll give you all the coverage you need in Sportsnet.ca right here in Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and of course on television, on the television side, on Sportsnet. You tweeted out today something that I had completely forgotten about. I knew it was kind of coming, but I didn't realize that this was the actual day. The collective bargaining agreement between Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association expires 1 year from today.
Yeah.
Normally, well, I was going to say not normally. 20 years ago, we'd all be panicking. But I think now, given how the most recent CBAs have been handled, is there anybody in baseball that thinks this won't be done?
I certainly think that it's going to be done. I think that's the general sense. And it's amazing. I mean, it goes to show that if you have the financial pieces in place, mm-hmm. then travel times on getaway days or, you know, what the major league per diem is, that has a way of working itself out. So it's not to say that there are guarantees. You know, they still have to figure out what the luxury tax threshold is going to be. And there are some real hard discussions that are going to have to take place in the next calendar year. But, you know, when Rob Manfred was addressing it at the GM meetings and, you know, talking about what they have to do in the course of the next 12 months to get this done, he didn't really seem overly concerned. He said, okay, we'll start talking about this in February and see what we can get done. But realistically, the big pieces are in place. And so I don't think there's a ton of cause for concern at this point.
No, and it's remarkable because, I mean, I can remember covering baseball and every approaching end of the CBA, you would immediately start writing stories or talking to people about, you know, the possibility of a lockout, the possibility of a strike. And I think you're right. The game's just got so much money in it right now that it's really a matter of dealing almost, I'm not going to call them lifestyle issues, but it's really almost a matter of dealing with nuts and bolts issues. And it struck me as odd because the NBA is flush with money too, and it's going to be flush with money next year. But it's remarkable how many people in the NBA think that there could be labor Armageddon coming up. Whereas baseball, the sport that always used to have this, like I said, I think there was a Sports Business Journal did a poll where they polled professional sports executives, something like 6%. Thought there would be a baseball labor stoppage. I mean, ridiculously low. Everybody just thinks that it's going to be, that's going to be taken care of.
And even in spite of the fact that there are two new leaders in place.
Right.
I mean, you have Rob Manfred replacing Bud Selig, and Michael Wiener obviously passed away, unfortunately. So you have Tony Clark. And so even with these two new leaders in place, it seems as though everyone seems to be getting along so far. And if the money continues pouring in and you're looking at a $9 billion industry, I think you're going to find a way to carve that up. And all indications are that, you know, Major League Baseball and the players are on track as far as what the next 12 months might offer.
What are the issues from the Blue Jays' point of view, do you think? I mean, look, the team is owned by a television, by a communications company. So anything that affects television, by extension, affects the Blue Jays. But what is the Jays' best case scenario when folks get around to talking revenue sharing? Is status quo the best case scenario for them?
I honestly don't know. I think that status quo certainly has worked out, but I don't know. I mean, I think that revenue sharing is a big part of the game. You're splitting up a pretty big pie. So far, it hasn't stopped the Blue Jays from contending, but I think realistically that that process helps some, like, really small market teams. Mm-hmm. We're talking the Tampa Bays and Oaklands and Milwaukee's of the world more so than it would help the Blue Jays.
Would you expect to see the international draft addressed in this CBA, or is that something that we're still maybe another CBA away from actually getting a grasp on?
I think that it'll be addressed. I mean, it seems as though Major League Baseball's been pushing toward this for a while, mm-hmm. so they want to get it done. And whether it happens now or maybe a little bit later on, I think one of the tough things about an international draft is there's so many logistical issues. I mean, you have countless teenage baseball players playing around the world, and the idea of identifying them all within a system, as much as there's chaos in a lot of ways when it comes to signing Latin American players, it's a system that has kind of worked, and there's a certain routine to it. Mm-hmm. So to try to organize that would be a huge undertaking. But at some point, Major League Baseball has to do it.
In conversation with Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet.ca. All right, let's and thank you for sending out that tweet to remind us all.
There it goes.
There it goes. Let's return the conversation to the Blue Jays. Jay Happ, the 3-year contract for Jay Happ. I know Keith Law has written that, not that Keith Law is the be-all and end-all, but he does have a certain amount of, writes with a certain amount of authority, I think we can say, has suggested that it was an overreach on the part of the Blue Jays. How did you view that contract?
Well, it's certainly not a bargain. I mean, that's, Jay Happ did great for himself. He got a lot of money, and he turned a couple good months into a very nice contract. But at the same time, the Blue Jays are paying for a certain amount of certainty, a certain amount of upside. I think when you look around the game, Scott Feldman got 3 years and $30 million. Jeremy Guthrie got a multi-year deal. Tim Hudson, Jake Peavy, guys at the end of their careers. Like, it's really not that remarkable to be a starting pitcher and earning $12, $13 million. I know that there can be a certain amount of sticker shock, especially when you compare it to other sports, but really baseball, you know, for the reasons we were talking about a minute ago, is such a lucrative business that if you're earning 12, 13 million, that doesn't mean you're a superstar. They're paying Jay Happ to be a pretty solid starter. So as long as he can do that, it's kind of like the Estrada deal. As long as these guys can provide, let's say, a 4 ERA, then they'll be worth that contract. They don't need to be the dominant pitchers mm-hmm. they were toward the end of last season.
Barry Bonds has resurfaced in the news, and we're going to be talking about this in the next hour, but I wanted to talk to you about this. The idea that Barry Bonds may end up going to the Miami Marlins as a hitting coach, which knowing the way Jeffrey Loria, the Marlins owner, thinks, and knowing the way he kind of likes to collect personalities, he likes to be associated with some of the bigger names. Generally, they have Yankees ties, but he's got this thing for surrounding himself with people and making a splash. How do you view the possibility of Barry Bonds joining a team as a hitting coach? And would you have an issue with it, given his status in the game as, I mean, he's still kind of persona non grata for a lot of people.
Yeah, I wouldn't have an issue with it. I was surprised when I saw this. I did not see this coming at all. I think it would be entertaining in a way to see a team with Don Mattingly and Ichiro and Barry Bonds. It would, Giancarlo Stanton, I don't know, it would kind of make for this weird drama. I don't know if the idea of Barry Bonds, I mean, you covered him, so you would have some insight into this, but is it crazy to think that he would, you know, fit in with this team? Like, could that work over the course of 6-7 months?
You know, the only thing that, and Travis McKenzie mentioned, my producer mentioned this to me, Bob Nightingale of USA Today, who knows Bonds as well as anybody personally and has covered the Bonds family for a long time, said that he found the weirdest thing about it. And that's kind of got me thinking. But he said he found the weirdest thing about it was just the notion of Barry being out of the Bay Area more than Barry being with the Marlins. And the more I thought about that, I thought, you know, Mark McGwire going back to the Cardinals as hitting coach and then eventually going on to the Dodgers, it made sense that he would go back, that he would sort of try to get his baseball life together again in St. Louis because it was the one city where he retained an inordinate amount of popularity. I don't know. Barry Bonds, I guess you could look at it and say the ballpark's normally empty in Florida, so there's not going to be that animosity towards Barry Bonds. But the only city that Barry Bonds has ever really felt that people, and even the media to a certain degree, has felt that people have had his back is San Francisco. And I think Nightingale's right and surprising that he would want to leave that cocoon to go to Florida, to go to Miami.
And the other thing is, with Bonds returning to the circuit, if he was going around the league the first time, there would be swarms of media.
What do you think the first story is when the Miami Marlins go to New York?
Right.
What's the first story in spring training if you're the Miami Marlins? And, you know, Barry, Barry doesn't do interviews. And I'm not saying that the hitting coach necessarily has to be, you know, a guy who can fill up your notebook. But traditionally, the hitting coach's relationship, as you well know, the hitting coach's relationship with the media that covers the team is, I mean, it's almost as if he's the guy you go to bounce stuff off of if you're talking about a particular player. And there's some hitting coaches that'll, you know, talk your ears off. There are others, like Brooke Jacoby. You can ask him about something to a specific hitter, and he's going to give you an answer. But I mean, it's not going to be a quotable answer because he doesn't really want to be quoted. But if you ask a good question, you'll get a good answer. And it's the same thing with the pitching coach. Generally, these are guys that if you cover the team on a day-to-day basis, you need to have access to in order to make sure you're on the right path, because a lot of times you can't ask the manager stuff. Man, I'd hate like hell to be the first guy to ask Barry, have to ask Barry Bonds about is Giancarlo Stanton. Giancarlo Stanton said he's done something different with his stance and that you suggested it. How do you think Barry Bonds is going to react to that?
Or even as a player, if you're a player and you're coming up, you know, let's say you're Jeff Mathis. I know he's a free agent, but you're trying to talk hitting with Barry Bonds. I mean, really, like that would take some adjusting, and maybe it would happen. I know that, you know, some great hitters have gone on to be great hitting coaches, but it's not a guarantee either, and that can be a tough transition for some athletes to make, especially when they are at that elite level.
Yeah, you know, and there are guys like Dusty Baker and Don Baylor who, God, Don, but they were different guys.
Even
as players.
Even
Cito, exactly. You know, went on to be really, really good, real good hitting coaches. But I mean, Baylor, Baker, and Cito, they were all, you could still talk to them. You know, you could still talk to them. And that would be the thing that would concern me a little bit, at least, about Barry Bonds. Ben, it was great of you to do this.
Happy to do it.
Appreciate you doing this. When is the next At the Letters podcast up?
Today. We are hoping to be joined by Ray Searidge to talk Jay Happ and Pirates pitching.
Excellent. The Pirates pitching coach who is credited, and I think Arden Zwelling wrote a terrific piece on the weekend talking about the change that Ray Searidge made to Jay Happ's delivery. And indeed, Tony LaCava referred to it when we talked to him on Monday about how he is a different pitcher now. He's much more direct to the plate, and it kind of makes his pitches a little more, it makes him a little more effective, and which is helpful because the one thing about Jay Happ is he's a left-hander with good velocity. You don't always get that. So I'll look forward to that. So the At the Letters podcast will be up. Is it up yet or will be up?
It'll be up later today.
Up later today on sportsnet.ca. The interview will be with Ray Searidge, the Pittsburgh Pirates pitching coach, considered to be one of the more broader thinkers in the game, and a guy who had a significant role in turning around Jay Happ's season with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Chris Johnson, senior hockey writer and insider for Sportsnet, will join us. It's a Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Come on, come on, come on. Get through it. Come on, come on, come on.
Love's the greatest thing.
Come on, come on.
All right, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show. Howard Beck, national basketball writer for Bleacher Report, will join us at 11 o'clock. We'll talk about Kobe Bryant. Howard covered Kobe for much of his career with the L.A. Lakers. And we will have the Lakers and 76ers game tonight at 7 p.m. on Sportsnet 1. It will be Kobe Bryant's last game in a Lakers jersey in his hometown, unless the Lakers and Sixers meet in the NBA Finals this year. Yeah. So that'll be at 7 p.m. on Sportsnet 1. You get to see. By God, that could be the. Could that be the worst NBA game of all time? I mean, I know I'm doing a crappy job of selling it, but the Lakers are on an 18. Or the Sixers are 0-18. Kobe can't buy a basket. Finals. We can make a drinking game out of it. The final score will be 21. Final score will be 21-20. Kobe will be 1 for 50. Anyhow, it'll be good fun. I mean, it's like having someone tell you that there's going to be this colossal, you know, explosion or whatever at a certain area, if you're there at a certain time. The Philly fans will have something to cheer for. That's right. So Lakers and 76ers, 7 p.m. tonight on Sportsnet 1. Kobe Bryant's final hometown game. Do we have Monsieur Johnson with us? Chris Johnson's a senior hockey writer and insider for Sportsnet. You can follow him on Twitter at Reporter Chris. Have you dried away your tears yet, Chris, after watching Garrett Sparks?
I have. I'm not sure if Garrett has. And, you know, that's the great thing. I mean, what I thought was really cool, Jeff, about last night was we all kind of got to meet this guy over the course of the evening. I mean, it's not as though he's, you know, he's not like a William Nylander, the type of prospect that's been much discussed and written about and talked about. And when he does eventually make his NHL debut, people will already feel like they know him. I mean, in Garrett Sparks, you had someone that a lot of fans wouldn't be familiar with. And you see his parents in the stands on the broadcast last night. And then obviously after the game when he broke into tears, was a pretty sincere and genuine moment from him.
Yeah, you know, and I made the point in the first hour that it's kind of remarkable. And I was thinking of this as I was watching that. You know, all the stuff we were talking about last year's collection of Toronto Maple Leafs and how unlikable they were for a variety of reasons, and not to rehash those reasons, but just how they were a hard team to cheer for. And, you know, here's a guy that if you're a Toronto fan, you know, we don't know where his career is going to go. We may have our suspicions where it's going to go. But here's a guy where if you're a Toronto fan, you're probably going to watch his next start and be openly rooting for the guy.
You'll probably be rooting for him for a long time, you know, no matter how many starts he ends up getting on this tour of duty in the NHL. I mean, I think that that's something that's going to stick with him, that kind of moment. And, you know, Brendan Shanahan himself, Jeff, has talked about that. I remember at the last year, at the season-ending press conference, you know, he said he wants players that want to play for the team, that show sort of an open pride in being part of the organization. And, you know, it was a clear sort of shot at, you know, without exactly saying it, was saying that he felt that there was too many on last year's team that didn't feel that way. But now, I guess, as you're ushering in some new players and new faces, you know, it's an opportunity to get to know some other players and see that they are proud to be part of the organization and, you know, might even be able to help it get to better days and time here.
Should mention, by the way, that Garrett Sparks will join Hockey Central at noon this afternoon on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And Sportsnet, you know, and it's kind of odd too, because in a lot of ways you can make the case that if, you know, if Garrett Sparks turns into Scott Darling or something like that, Chris, you can make the case that of all the goaltenders or of the three goaltenders here, he's the one most likely to be back next year.
Well, certainly, because the club controls his future in terms of he doesn't need a new contract, but he's a restricted free agent, and you know, based on his age and his performance this year in the AHL, I mean, he's a legitimate prospect for the Leafs now. I don't want to portray it at all as though last night was just sort of like a Rudy moment and we're never going to hear from this guy again. And I mean, what really bodes well for him is when you see goaltenders in particular perform in the lower levels of pro hockey, be it the ECHL where he had the best save percentage last season, or the AHL where he's been one of the best goalies this year, that tends to carry over to the NHL. That usually is shown not to be a fluky, you know, performance level that is unsustainable. I mean, sometimes there are players that put up big numbers in the NHL as forwards that they can't make the leap. But usually for goalies, they can. And, you know, it's only one game for Garrett Sparks, and, you know, I'm not certain how long we'll see him around right now, but in the future, you know, that this is a legitimate prospect, as I mentioned, for the Leafs, and then a guy, you know, that I think is going to, you know, further, you know, I guess, cloud the waters when it comes to the goaltending of today and tomorrow as the Leafs look to make some decisions there.
Chris, what are the Leafs' options with Jonathan Bernier? What could they do with this guy?
Well, the most likely option that I think we're going to hear discussed, especially if Sparks plays well and James Reimer returns from his injury in the near future, is, you know, they do potentially have the option to send him to the American Hockey League on a two-week conditioning stint. It can only last as long as that 2 weeks. He doesn't need waivers or anything to go there, and they can only do it the one time this season. But that, I would think that's going to become a possibility, or there's at least a chance of that. I mean, beyond that, you know, they can explore trade routes. They can, I guess, contemplate putting him on waivers and losing him for nothing, which I think is an unlikely option at this point. But as long as the other two guys are playing well and Reimer is healthy, I mean, we might have a three-goalie situation here for a little while, three healthy goalies, if Reimer returns soon.
How do you think the rest of the room, how do you think the dressing room will respond if Bernier, if somehow there's an indication of, I don't want to say favoritism to Bernier, but if there's an indication of, well, we have this guy under contract for a while, we really can't do anything else with him, we kind of have to sort of need to dress him and play him. How do you think that would go over in that dressing room right now? Because, I mean, the one thing I really like about what Mike Babcock has done is I really do get the sense that, in addition to talking about culture change and all this stuff, I mean, he realizes that one of the ways you can enact culture change is to reward good performance and sit guys who aren't performing well. I mean, you saw what he did with Peter Holland. And reputation only counts for so much with Mike Babcock. How do you think the reaction in the dressing room would change, or what the tone would be like if somehow Jonathan Bernier is still there and goes into a regular rotation?
Well, I think if anything, it's unlikely we're going to see that, because there's been no favoritism. I mean, I guess the closest thing to favoritism might have been giving him the number one job coming out of training camp, you know, sort of not affected by what the performances were during the couple weeks of training camp and the exhibition games. But what's really struck me, I think Mike Babcock is a pretty plain guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any games here with what he's saying, and he's been very, very critical about Jonathan Bernier. Really hasn't, in my estimation, gone out of his way in any way to defend his poor performances or to make excuses for them, or you know, to say we're going to be patient with him. I mean, it's quite the contrary. He's basically said we've given him the opportunity, he's not taking it, we're giving it to someone else. So if the response in the room, I would think, is that everyone else, and we've seen it to a lesser degree with the other positions, they'll be on guard. I think everyone knows that the sort of built-in loyalty isn't there yet for anybody. And, you know, even someone like Jonathan Bernier, the anointed number one, a guy with a sort of a more favorable contractual situation for the organization, you know, someone, if you're looking at it from that, through that glass, should, you know, probably getting a bit more benefit of the doubt to try to get him back to where he is, just because, you know, otherwise it could create a problem. You know, all that's been thrown out the window. And everyone knows, you know, that it is about performance now, I believe. And clearly Bernier hasn't performed well enough for Mike Babcock's liking. And the coach has not hid that really from any day in the last month. He's had very sharp comments consistently on Bernier's play.
In conversation with Chris Johnson on the Jeff Blair Show, your article on Connor McDavid on Sportsnet.ca was very interesting, talking about Connor McDavid kind of taking lessons from Tony Romo and his rehab and his return. And I'm wondering if you think that Connor McDavid learned something about himself last year when he came back, or when he had to recover from that hand injury as a result of that fight, and maybe it was a little bit of a lesson for him in a positive way, you know, and that you really, it's one thing to have a bunch of people tell you, hey, take your time, heal, that's the way you do it, don't rush back, and another thing to do that and have it actually work out and go, yeah, you know what, all that stuff everybody's telling me, it works.
Right, and it's slightly different circumstances, because if you remember last year, one of the things looming over McDavid when he suffered that injury was, would he get back for the World Juniors? You know, would he be able to play in that tournament? We don't really have, at least in my eyes, the same kind of, you know, a pressing return date. I mean, other than we know that every player, especially someone in his shoes, would want to play as absolutely soon as possible. But, you know, I think he'll be smart. And, you know, he's got good representation working for the Bobby Orr Group as his agency. And obviously Bobby had a fantastic NHL career, but one cut short by injuries. And, you know, I do think the Oilers will take the long view because, you know, as we've already seen with last night's loss, I mean, they're more in the conversation for the draft lottery again than the playoffs. And, you know, there's no competitive reasons why they would want this guy back, you know, soon. So I would expect ultimate caution to be shown here because, you know, really it's more about the future for Connor McDavid and the Oilers than now. And you know, while he is ahead of schedule, I think everyone's trying to tap the brakes. It's sort of my feeling or my read on the situation here that you know, that they're not going to rush him back. And it might end up being a little bit longer than, you know, a timeline that's been thrown out there is mid-January. I wouldn't be surprised if it's closer to the All-Star break at the end of January or even beyond that.
Chris, how concerned are people around the Oilers that I'm not going to say the guy's brittle or anything like that, but, you know, we've already seen, we have evidence in this league, or we saw Sidney Crosby, different situation, but we saw his career, you know, damaged by the concussion. Certainly, I think we can say that he was removed from the game for a while. You know, is there any concern with Connor McDavid that, you know, boy, this could be one of those situations where because of the way the guy plays, you know, he's always going to be, people are going to be hitting him. He's probably going to be engaging in contact himself, that this sort of could be a regular thing. Not that he's going to break his shoulder, but that he's a guy who is not going to necessarily go out of his way to avoid trouble all the time, I guess is the way I'd put it.
Well, you know, I've never heard that expressed. I mean, one thing about McDavid, he's in absolutely fantastic shape, sort of in addition to his God-given gifts. And it was really a freak accident, you know, type of play where he was, you know, ridden into the end boards. And you know, I haven't even heard that sort of quietly floated as an idea around, you know, from anyone, you know, connected to the organization or that knows Connor well. You know, I do think it's just unfortunate. I mean, let's face it, we all want the best players playing. And he had made, in a span of just the 13 games he played, like, I found the Oilers were already appointment viewing. I was watching every game, you know, to see what he was going to do. He was really coming on. And I think it's, you know, it has cast a bit of a pall on the season because, you know, this is an embarrassing situation for Edmonton, not McDavid's injury, but, you know, where they sit now with 30th again a possibility and just, you know, unable, it seems, to get out of, you know, the same sort of cycle they've been in. And I'm not sure what the long-term answer is, but I don't think that they're worried about McDavid, but they're just being very, very careful. I mean, hey, they're treating him differently. One thing I found interesting is that they've been sending him video clips of, you know, their various systems work on the power play and things to keep his mind obviously engaged in what they're doing, but to make him feel a part of, you know, the program there still, even while he's out, because sometimes injured players do feel a little detached from the team. I think they're going to great lengths to keep them interested and, you know, they're expecting him to save things in a lot of ways, even though they'd never say that. And they need to make sure he's in the best shape possible when he comes back.
Chris, I know this is a loaded question, but what do the Oilers have to do? You watched them last night and you know, okay, I understand that they've got a new coach, there's a new structure, I get all that. But, you know, I also operate under the assumption, as I think most people do, that one of the things really, really talented, naturally gifted athletes are good at, for the most part, is, you know, is falling into structure, or at least being able to understand some of the things that are trying to be implemented. You have to have a certain amount of athletic sense to be a great athlete, and you should be able to fit into a certain structure, a certain system. I watched last night. I didn't think they worked particularly hard. What is it with that team?
Well, I think it's sort of a two-pronged effect. And you know, we have to remember Peter Chiarelli and Todd McLellan are new there. And, you know, I do think that does allow some time where we don't overreact and say it's not working. And so first of all, you have McClelland, and you know, really by all means, a top NHL coach, and you have to believe he's starting to get things right from a systems perspective. I think more importantly, you know, what needs to happen is at some point, I would think within the next 6 months, when Peter Chiarelli has a real take on what he has with the organization, you know, he's got to, I believe, you know, address the needs on the blue line. I do think it starts there. And it probably means trading one of their top forwards. I know that's been discussed, but, you know, it's the most clear and obvious answer, I guess, to, you know, how they might, you know, go about getting some higher-end players on the blue line. But, you know, I do, and I hate to say it, but I do think that's going to take a bit of time. But, you know, I think that's what the priorities have to be. Then obviously getting McDavid back healthy and all that will go on, you know, on its way. But, you know, I still think that there's some personnel issues there, and you know, you just can't solve those problems right away, especially with a new GM. I think the most dangerous thing you would do is if you started, you know, making a lot of rash decisions. I think you really have to be careful about what you do and make the, you know, make sure you arm yourself with the best knowledge to make that decision. But it's a tough year. I mean, with the new building next year, should help with some hope, but you know, I do think we're going to see a vastly different team on the ice as well in terms of personnel.
Chris, I appreciate you doing this, man. Thank you.
Hey, no problem, Jeff. Thank you.
It's Chris Johnson, senior hockey writer and insider on Sportsnet. You can follow him on Twitter at Reporter Chris. If you're any type of hockey fan, you already are. The Leafs will be in Scotiabank Wednesday night hockey, which, as the name would suggest, is on tomorrow night. Be in Winnipeg to play the Jets. That game will be on Sportsnet Ontario and Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Our Leafs Nation pregame with Gord Stellick and Todd Lyshko is at 7 p.m. on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Hockey Central's pregame will be at 7 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. The puck drop will be just after 7:30 with Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph doing the call of the game. Dave Randorf, Craig Simpson, and Scott Oak will have it for you in Sportsnet Ontario. Our Leafs Nation postgame with Stellick and Hlischko will be immediately after the final horn in Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And we'll also have the Bruins and Oilers at 9:30 p.m. in Sportsnet 1 as part of our Scotiabank Wednesday night hockey presentation. As I said, we will have tonight's game between the Los Angeles Lakers and Philadelphia 76ers at 7 p.m. on Sportsnet 1. Kobe Bryant's final hometown game. Howard Beck is a national basketball writer for Bleacher Report. He covered Kobe Bryant for much of his time in Los Angeles, and Howard Beck will join us when the Jeff Blair Show continues on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.